The Way Out Podcast, episode 351.
What is your name?
My name is Lisa Sarges.
Lisa, what was your substance of choice or DOC or behavior of choice if you had one?
I'm a compulsive overeater in recovery.
I like how you said that and phrased that, because I think it describes very well what you're in recovery from. What is your clean and or sober date, or how would you describe that in your recovery?
So I do go to 12-step meetings. I started in 2018. I was not consistent. I don't have an actual date, but I have been consistently attending meetings now starting in September.
That's fantastic. And we ask that for a reason, because we get a lot of different answers when it comes to that. Some people keep one, some people don't. It helps some people, it doesn't help other people. And there's no right way, right? There's no correct or one way to keep or not keep an abstinence or recovery date.
Yes, everyone is different in recovery.
It's extremely individual. So we like the spectrum of answers we get when we ask that question. Lisa, how do you serve the recovery community?
I have several ways. One is with YouTube. I have two different channels. One is about, you know, weight loss, eating disorder recovery, even though they've kind of been strange with censorship regarding any kind of recovery. They're not really allowing addiction to be talked about. So you have to be very careful.
Right.
I also have a book out, How I Overcame an Eating Disorder and Lost 140 Pounds. So Diary of a Fat Girl. So with my book. And with just teaching in general.
Yeah, I love that. And it's an interesting world we live in today with the content filters that may be well-intended in terms of trying to filter out content that promotes eating disorders or addictive substances and behaviors, but clearly it can have unintended consequences and filter out content that is promoting recovery from those addictions and disorders.
Exactly. So what they said in their policy statement was that although they understand the need to educate and share positive experiences, the language can be very triggering. And so they will be limiting it to 18 and over, which, you know, I do get that.
Yeah.
And they will be, you know, filtering a certain verbiage. And I just feel that they're being very selective about things that they filter.
Sure. Yeah, I get that. And it's unfortunate because we have content that's very much the same way. It's extremely graphic at times because that helps us relate to what it was like. And so that we can then identify with people that had the same issues as we had and then recovered. And that is really instrumental in folks beginning their recovery journeys, is relating and then finding some hope and some inspiration there.
It's important for people to hear that they're not alone in their addictive behaviors, and that the extremes and the rock bottoms that we've hit, you know, to find company there and to understand that you can recover, and that you're not weird or freakish or unique in your experiences. The me too. Yeah, me too.
Yeah, without question. Identifying with people that have gone to some of the extremes that we have is really important in terms of not feeling alone and not feeling incurable or like we're so uniquely different. I thought it a million times, like nobody's felt like this. Nobody's done this. Nobody's had this train of thought before. It kept me sick.
Yes. Isolation will keep us sick.
Absolutely.
And I, you know, it's not the only social media outlet, even though it's a good one for video. I'm still out there doing what I can to help people.
That's fantastic. And Diary of a Fat Girl, you know, we're going to get into this in the main part of the interview. I was a fat kid growing up for a stretch, not my entire childhood, but a really important part of it I was. And I was tormented and bullied mercilessly for a number of years right after my mom died. So it was a really traumatic experience. So we're going to talk about, you know, all the things that can get wrapped up in that, which I think a lot of people have experienced. So I'm looking forward to that very, very much. Lisa, what does recovery mean to you?
Recovery means self-awareness and an expansion of choices that will lead to a healthier present and future.
Oh, I love that. That's fantastic. Really does highlight that recovery affords us the freedom to make positive, healthy choices that are consistent with the people we're trying to become.
Yes. When I was at the worst part of my addictive behavior, I was definitely not self-aware. I knew I was hurting myself, but I had no idea what was driving the behavior or how to get help.
Yeah, that self-awareness is such a huge piece of allowing us to be able to recover in a meaningful way. And that's an ongoing process for me.
Yes. Are we ever really fully recovered? So when we introduce ourselves in meetings, you know, we'll always introduce, I'm an alcoholic or I'm an addict, or we say present tense.
Absolutely. Without question. It's a good reminder for me, too, when I say that. Indeed. Welcome, Way Out faithful and first timers, to this week's installment of the Way Out podcast. We appreciate your ears. Our mission is simple: to bring you powerful recovery stories and recovery power topics so you can jumpstart or re-energize your recovery from alcoholism and addiction. The Way Out podcast does not speak on behalf of, nor are we affiliated with, any 12-step organization. The Way Out podcast is a proud supporter of Transitions Daily. Would you like to join a free, anonymous online group that offers a daily topic email with popular recovery resources accompanied by a secret Facebook group for discussion? Go to dailyaaemails.com for more information about Transitions Daily. Don't forget to share dailyaaemails.com with friends, in meetings, and with sponsees in recovery. Make sure to check us out on the web at www.wayoutcast.com. There you can subscribe to ensure you get the latest episodes first on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Help us recover out loud by giving us a 5-star rating and review on your favorite podcast app. Your voice matters, so share your thoughts on recovery with us by calling us at 218-382-1960 or leaving a message with us on the Anchor app, available for Android and Apple. Someone, somewhere, needs to hear your share. Listen up, everyone. Certified and professional recovery coaching is now available by going to wayoutcast.com and then clicking on Recovery Coaching. We want to help you and those you know who want help in building a strong, rewarding, and enduring recovery. Let our recovery experience and training enhance and strengthen your recovery by visiting wayoutcast.com and then clicking on Recovery Coaching. Finally, a word of caution. This podcast may contain strong language and mature content. Listener discretion is advised. The Way Out podcast is on right now. I'm Charlie, and in this rendition of The Way Out, I'm pleased to bring you my interview with professor, author, and person in long-term recovery, Lisa Sarges. Lisa shares her journey to and through recovery from compulsive overeating, as well as physical and emotional trauma, in a way that cuts to the chase and gets down to the heart of the matter, which for her
was that her compulsive overeating was inextricably linked to an unwillingness to tolerate very specific dark emotions, which is what Lisa refers to them as, and is rather apropos to what negative emotions feel like. This revelation for Lisa didn't come easy. In fact, it came at quite the high cost, an experience many of us can relate to. Understanding her triggers was just the beginning for Lisa, as she then leaned into 12-step recovery, Qigong, mindfulness, and a daily spiritual practice to build a happier, healthier life. As Lisa so profoundly states, and I paraphrase, if you earnestly connect to your spirituality in a way that is meaningful to you every day, you will change, which indeed has been my experience and the experience of many that have shared their recovery journeys on this here podcast, just like the one from none other than Lisa Sarjaes that's about to unfold before your very ears. So listen up. Lisa Sarjaes, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us here on the Way Out podcast. You are a professor, you're an author, and you're a person in long-term recovery. And you're here with us to share your journey to and through recovery to this point, as well as about what you're doing with your YouTube channel and about your book, Diary of a Fat Girl. Before we get into any of that, why don't you take a moment to introduce yourself to the Way Out podcast audience? Tell us where you're from, a little bit about yourself, and we'll get started.
Okay, my name is Lisa Sarjaes. My students call me Professor Lisa. I've been teaching college for 21 years. I teach religions of the world. I say I noticed that I was a compulsive overeater starting at age 5. Mm. I had deep emotional issues that caused me to self-soothe, but in a very self-destructive way, using food as my drug of choice. And I wrote a book about it after my third weight loss surgery, because I wanted to be held accountable to in my recovery. I wasn't going to 12-step at the time. I had a blog and I blogged every day. That's how I held myself accountable. And I turned that blog into a book.
That's absolutely wonderful. Was the beginning of your compulsive eating, in terms of marking that at age 5, did you understand that in retrospect, in hindsight?
I knew that I was not supposed to be sneak eating the way I was.
Sure. Sure.
I noticed other people weren't as obsessed with food as I was. That was kind of my secret friend. And little by little, I realized it was a behavior I had to hide, that I had to feel ashamed of. But I didn't know it was an addiction that I could get help with until I was much older, maybe 17.
Yeah. Yeah. So you had a pretty early awareness that you ate differently than other people, and that awareness of that difference brought some shame and some of those feelings, I bet, huh?
Yeah, like I knew I had to sneak eat. So the opening line of my book is, it all started with the skim milk, because my pediatrician told my mother, well, she's a few pounds overweight, maybe make some dietary changes, put her on skim milk instead of whole milk. And that really just began my mother's, you know, very forceful and uncritical behavior toward me as far as managing everything I ate. And in order to express myself and my individuality, I wanted to choose my own food.
Sure. Sure.
And it wasn't just choosing food. It was stuffing myself to the point of pain.
Yeah. So this was kind of an ongoing contention between you and your mom growing up. Yeah.
Yes, very much so. And I do write quite frankly about that.
Huh,
not everyone likes that idea. They're like, well, you shouldn't talk about your mom that way. Well, she shouldn't have behaved that way.
And we got to start from a place of honesty. There's no doubt about that, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's good. Well, okay. So at age five, you don't eat like other people. You have an awareness of this. You're sneak eating and there's binge eating. And that starts to escalate as you get older. Is that correct?
That's correct. Because, of course, you get a little more freedom as you get older. When you're 5 years old, you know, you eat what people give you.
Right.
You could sneak into a kitchen or a cupboard to get things you're not supposed to have. But when you're a teenager, you have access to food, you have money, you could, you know, buy things or help yourself to things more easily. So yeah, it did get a lot worse as I got older. And at about 16 years old, I discovered that you could induce vomiting. And so I became bulimic as well.
Sure. Which probably at the time seemed like a great deal, right? I can eat all I want and not have any of the consequences, right?
That's what I thought. But you can't get it all up and out of your body.
Sure.
And because I did it so much and so severely, I still gained quite a bit of weight.
Right. And there's a lot of other negative effects that behavior can inflict on us.
Chronic sore throats.
Yeah.
Dangerous infections. Yes. Yeah. And digestive disorder.
Right.
GERD. Yeah. When I 17, I developed, like, I guess they didn't call it GERD back then, but you know, I had the acid reflux.
Right. Absolutely. Well, my dad always used to say that I had the quickest hand to the cookie jar growing up. So I really do believe, Lisa, that food was that first source of comfort that I had before I discovered my ultimate drug of choice, which was alcohol. And before I knew about alcohol or had somewhat regular access to it, food was the thing that comforted me. And I gained a lot of weight after my mom died. And I believe that I have big addict and alcoholic switches right from the beginning, right from the get. Okay. And you know, my mom dying was like pouring gasoline on that campfire. And I liked food before my mom died a lot. I liked it a whole lot better after she died. And it really propelled me into a myriad of addictive behaviors, including food, but also drugs and alcohol. And anytime that I couldn't get my drug of choice, food became that secondary piece. And I also became aware that I would binge on certain things. Never went to the purging piece, but you know what though? Restricting, right? That was real for me. And actually at the end for me, I was very much on a sort of binge and restrict kind of mode, along with a pretty constant flow of alcohol, and got real sick. And that was a really toxic combination. So I can very much relate to that. And disentangling that stuff in recovery has been just a huge process. And understanding the myriad of things that I'm capable of doing in order to change my feelings has been instrumental for me.
Yeah. I was for so many years, I'm 58 years old now, decades of not being able to practice moderation. It was all or nothing. Either I'm binging and purging and overeating, or I'm fasting to the point of needing to faint.
Right.
But to be able to have just a healthy, normal relationship with food is something I still work on every day.
Yeah, absolutely. No question. Okay, so when is your first reckoning with your compulsive eating? How old were you and what happened?
I think I was 18 years old. My boyfriend at the time had, his father was like me, which is how he worded it, a sneak eater with sneak candy bars. His father was, you know, very obese. I was not yet at that point. And I don't know, because life before the internet, when I say I looked something up, I don't even remember. How did I do that? Library? Like, what did I do? But I did, and I found Overeaters Anonymous. And I had my boyfriend drive me there. He didn't come in with me or anything, but he drove me there. And I went there for a while. And I saw other people with the same behaviors. And I'm like, oh, it's a disease. I get it now.
Yeah. Okay. So you had a pretty early experience with Overeaters Anonymous and recognizing that other people behaved like you behaved and were in recovery. What happens after you are introduced to this?
I couldn't keep it up. Well, I couldn't. I didn't keep it up. My emotional pain was so severe and I had no other coping mechanism that I just needed my drug of choice back to be able to handle life, to be able to handle a mother who was appears to be narcissistic. Like when I say narcissistic, like the personality disorder of narcissism.
Right.
And I needed something. And without counseling, without a group, food was my friend and it was reliable and it was just me and food.
Yeah. So I kept it. Now, boy, I can relate to that. I had a couple of stints, one early at 16 in treatment and then again a nudge from the judge in my early 20s. And I just wasn't ready, you know, and the drug of choice was still working. It was still working. And the emotional pain and turmoil was at a rapid boil, right? And the only thing that really took it away, because I didn't have any tools either, was the drug of choice. And the consequences weren't quite severe enough in my mind to, you know, I'm looking at these other people that, lost homes and marriages and, you know, all these other things. And, you know, I didn't relate to any of that. And, you know, I really truly believed that I could manage it. I knew I didn't do it normally. I knew that. I didn't really want to admit that to anybody, but I knew that. And I would admit it inside of 12-step meetings in those two stints, sure, but I wouldn't admit it to anybody else. And really deep, deep, deep down inside, I wanted to prove to myself and everybody else that I could manage this thing because I was terrified of life without it.
Correct. Yes. I was like, no, I'm fine. Yeah, no, I'm good. I won't do it too much anymore. I'm good.
Exactly. Now that I know what I know, thank you, people. Thank you for all this great information. This has been helpful. I appreciate it. I'm going to go now do this thing on my own and manage it. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Right? How does that end up working out as time rolls on?
Not well. Hit rock bottom a number of times. Well, I did, certainly.
Well, you know, I'm glad you phrased it that way because I don't believe in rock bottoms. I think rock bottoms when we're dead.
Yeah.
And anything short of that is just a different bottom. When I got sober, ultimately, now 8+ years ago, it wasn't my lowest low. It just wasn't. There was other things that had happened prior to that that objectively could be conceived as a lower bottom. So our bottom is when we stop digging.
Yeah, right. When there's nothing left and we're in it, we're under it.
Yep. You just stop digging. That's your bottom right there. That's it. You know, some people have bottoms up here, some way down there, some in the middle. It doesn't matter. Yeah. When you stop digging, that's your bottom. And that's when your recovery can start. So tell me about that. You referenced that you had 3 surgeries mm-hmm. in an attempt to be able to get your weight into a healthy range. Yes.
Yes. So, remember, I was a researcher before we had internet, so I remember hearing my mother talk about a lady friend of hers who had her stomach stapled.
Oh, yeah, that was way in the early days when they were doing that.
In the 1960s, they would staple the stomach, make it smaller, and then do the bypass down here. In the very early days, they were doing these weight loss surgeries, and I remembered it. I had moved out of the house, but I was still very enmeshed with my very controlling and abusive mother. And so now that I didn't live at home, I had complete freedom to overeat anytime and all the time. And I gained about over 100 pounds in a year. So I was up to like over 300 pounds at that point. And I'm like, I will die if I don't do something to help myself. But I just couldn't stop the overeating. Plus, I was living with somebody who was also abusive. It was a mess. So I went to the library and I went to the little card catalog and looked up, you know, weight loss surgery. And I found, you know, articles. That's what you did. You found articles and you made phone calls. And yeah. I found someone who was doing what we now call the lap band.
Yeah.
That adjustable gastric band. And I went for the consult. He was reluctant. He says, you know, your psychological profile is that of an addict, and I'm not sure this is a good fit for you.
Mm.
But, you know, we're very cunning. And we can.
We are. We are.
We are convincing.
Yes.
I convinced him to do it. And he did. So, okay, great. Now, the thing is adjustable. They can make it tighter or looser through a saline injection into a little port. So how this brilliant mechanism worked was I just threw up 5 times a day.
Okay.
He had it really tight, and I would just throw. I lost 100 pounds like that. That was sure. easy. Just throw it up. Right. But the consequence is because there's this silicone band around your stomach, it became so irritated and full of scar tissue. It got so tight, I couldn't even get water down. And there was no more saline to withdraw from it to loosen it up.
Oh, wow.
So he had to reinstall it. That failed. He reinstalled that. There was a problem with that. And then I just couldn't be gutted open like a fish. They didn't do it laparoscopically back then.
Right. Right.
So I was like, screw it. Screw it. And went up to over 400 pounds.
Wow. Wow. And so after that, you're feeling pretty defeated, right? After a third failed surgery.
Yes. I'm like, well, you know, I know I'm an addict, and I knew I swindled my way, you know, swindled this doctor into doing this surgery. I just didn't know what to do. So I started trying different diets and different nutrition things, just trying to have my way, to be able to eat but not gain too much weight. And sometimes I would still, you know, induce vomiting and trying to exercise. It was a mess. But I knew I was going to die again. There's always, I know I'm going to die. I know I'm going to die. I'm like, I will die if I don't get help.
Yeah.
So I went looking for someone to take the thing out of me because I had a chronic cough, chronic pain. It was digging into me. I'm like, maybe if I just had freedom and I could eat a bunch of raw vegetables, I could, you know, get things under control. And I couldn't find a surgeon to take the band out. Well, I was led to a brilliant surgeon who deals with difficult cases. And he says, I'll do it for you. I'll take that band out of you, but you'll have to let me turn it into a gastric bypass because you're dangerously obese. And that's the only way I'll do it. I'm like, fine, fine, just do it. And that was the beginning of the rest of my life.
And what was different coming out of that then?
Well, so the rock bottom I hit prior to that was my eating was so out of control and my blood sugar was so high. The little meter didn't even read a number. It just said high.
Oh, wow.
So that's over 700 points. That's like, why am I alive at this point? I don't know how I lived. Well, I do. God kept me alive.
Yeah.
I broke out into, it was biblical. Remember Job and his boils?
Oh, yeah.
I was covered in them. Carbuncles, multiple root boils. I was septic. And I had to be forced to go to the hospital for help, where I remained for almost 3 weeks on the most expensive antibiotics that they had in an isolated room because my sores were open and no germs could come near me or I would die.
Wow.
It was bad. And so I'm laying there. You know, they had 2 different kinds of antibiotics dripping into me. And I'm laying there in pain, sad, desperate, knowing I can't control my eating, that I'm an addict. And I prayed to God. I'm like, you have to let me go. You have to let me die. I can't go on like this. Please understand if I give up tonight, overnight, you just take me. I said, but maybe let me sleep on it. Mm. And the morning, I'll let you know if I want to die or not. But if I decide to live, you're going to help me. And you have to make it very obvious that you're helping me. And I went to sleep. And in the morning, I said, all right, I'll live. Not because of my parents. Not because of my friends. I didn't want to leave my cats.
Oh, that's great. My fiance would love that reason. She would love that reason. Yeah, we have three cats, and I'm somewhere on the totem pole of in terms of importance, you know, just above our butthole cat. Okay. That's where I rate in the spectrum of importance. So, and I'm fine with that. And
I made it to the totem pole.
100%. 100%. And recovery has given me enough humility to be able to appreciate that and be just fine with that. That's great. Okay. So you have this conversation with God, and
yes,
this really, in large part, is the beginning of your recovery in earnest.
Yes. So I was as good as gold for about 3 months, measuring the blood sugar every day, eating super low carb, you know, portion control. But I found myself slipping around the holidays. And I'm like, no, I need help. And that's when I sought out this Dr. Davis, right, who did the surgery.
That's tremendous. And coming out of this surgery, you really... And I think that's, by the way, very instructive that we can have this really powerful experience and still find ourselves slipping and regressing. That's so common and so real. And so you have this surgery. What happens next?
People started accusing me of taking the easy way out, and I was furious about that.
Mm.
There's a video on YouTube. It went viral. It's like 80,000 hits of me covered in black and blue, sitting on my tub ledge crying. But how could you say this is the easy way out? It was a very complicated surgery, and they almost lost me on the table.
Wow.
But I had experts, and I had prayer, and I was hypnotized prior. So like I had everything on my side, and God wanted me to live. So I'm alive. But now I'm like, all right, how is this the easy way out? I have to prove to these people that this is not easy.
Yeah.
And that's when I started the blog. I'm like, I'm going to blog every day, and I'm going to go to the gym 6 days a week, and you're going to watch me fight.
Yeah.
Hopefully this is easy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for a whole year, I was the superstar of weight loss, doing everything right, going to that gym, blogging superstar. This is back in the day. I had the surgery in 2006 when blogging was like a big thing.
That was the thing. Yes. Yes.
But as usual, not addressing the root cause, which is an addiction,
mm-hmm,
started gaining weight back.
Sure.
And I'm like, oh no. Oh no, no, no.
Not again.
Exactly.
Not again. Yeah.
Surgery only lasts so long, the effects of surgery.
Sure.
Weight loss surgery. And then you could just start eating normally again. And I was, and there goes the weight now.
Right.
Now what?
Right. So then what? Because I think we could all so very much relate to that. Not again. It's coming back again. And I can see myself losing control over this. Right. And I'm powerless over it. I'm just powerless over this transformation that's happening to me, where my addiction is rearing its ugly head once again.
So I started back in research mode. Now we have the internet. Things are a little easier. And I'm like, there has to be a root cause. Now, I don't know why I'm not looking emotionally, but I do things my way. And it takes me 50 years to figure it out. So I like, there's got to be a nutritional reason that's causing me to want to overeat. And this is a very instructive set of years. I don't know if you remember, if you hear about this. He's a ginger. He's a redheaded guy, J.P. Sears. He's like a famous political. He does a lot of political comedy. He's got the long hair. He was a nutrition blogger back in the day.
Okay.
He was one of the people I followed. Matt Stone was another one. Josh Rubin was another one. These were all like the Weston A. Price, super, you know, farm to table people. And I'm like, this is really fascinating. They're like, you eat a lot of processed garbage food. You're hungry all the time. I'm like, then that's my problem. Sure. I overeat because I'm eating a lot of junk. So I became this farm to table raw milk advocate.
Yep.
And I followed all these guys. Matt Stone actually dedicated his first book to me. And we were all bloggers at the time. And it didn't help with my overeating. I just overate healthier foods.
Right.
But you get fuller faster. Let me tell you, if you're eating food from the farm, you're going to get fuller faster.
No doubt.
Much of a binge urge. So it helped, but it didn't solve the problem.
Sure.
There were a lot of years of doing that.
But it feels like to be, Lisa, somewhat analogous to my drinking history, in that when I started drinking, it was like everything, and I was just completely out of control, and I had enough blackout incidents with hard alcohol where I can't do that anymore. So hard alcohol is the problem. I'll switch to only beer, right? And that'll be okay. Or, you know, and it was a series of, well, tequila's the problem. Well, vodka's the problem, right? And no. I was the problem. I had to address the things within me that were causing me to want to over consume alcohol, right? And regardless of whether it was beer or tequila or vodka or rum, that didn't help. You know, sure, when I switched to beer, I didn't black out and, you know, teleport to different places and not know how. So it wasn't as bad, right? But it was just killing me a little bit slower at that point. And it feels like, you know, when you're talking about, well, okay, well, I'm not going to eat the junk food. I'm going to eat this and that, you know, really analogous to that.
Right. So, you know, it did help to re-nourish me. I had a lot of problems with anemia. I went through a lot of health challenges. It wasn't until recently that I was looking at my, because now everything's online, everything is my chart, this, plug in that. And you can see your doctor's notes about you.
Right.
Right on your phone.
Right.
Severely obese. I'm like, you SOB. How could you tell me that after everything I've been through? All the weight I've lost, all these surgeries, you're calling me severely obese? Well, yeah.
Yeah, right.
And what's the reason for that, Lise? And I'm like, well, because I sure do eat a lot still after all these years. Yeah. And it's not that I just like big portions. It's that I eat to soothe my emotions.
Yeah.
And I knew, I'm like, all right, do you want to die like this? Because that's what's going to happen if you don't get the right kind of help. If you don't do the right kind of recovery, which is emotional, and psychological, and spiritual.
That's the game changer, right?
Yep.
And understanding why we use, why we engage in these counterproductive thought and behavior patterns, addictions, is key in being able to change our behavior. And I too drank and sometimes ate to change my feelings. That was why. It was either not to feel something or to feel something. To feel happy, to feel euphoria, or to not feel all of the negative stuff. And in order to change my behavior, I had to address the core issues that were driving that behavior. And to your point, the emotional recovery was key for me. I say it all the time. I did EMDR therapy in parallel with my 12-step recovery, working the steps in order with a sponsor plus EMDR therapy. That was the secret combination for me. It unlocked my recovery and allowed me to get unstuck finally. And then I learned tools to be able to behave differently, meaning choose to act differently when I am uncomfortable. Sometimes it's just I'm bored and I don't know what to do with it. But a lot of times. Sometimes it's anxiety. Sometimes it's fear. Sometimes it's sadness, some sort of pain. And now I can use some tools to be able to act differently, choose a different action, rather than go to my default, which is drink or use or grab a bag of chips or smoke a cigarette or whatever that is, whatever I used to do to want to change my feelings, I could do something else. So tell me about what you did, Lisa, to address your emotional and spiritual health.
Well, I got very curious about my mother's personality disorder, and I became quite the expert on borderline personality disorder and narcissistic personality disorder. I should have gotten another master's on that, just that, or maybe even a doctorate. But looking at how you've been abused and the motivations of the abuser will not heal you. And in my studies, I realized that, well, what am I in response to this?
Yeah.
So I'm actually an Al-Anon. That's my 12-step group, because I cannot change the alcoholic. I cannot change the addict. I cannot change the narcissist. I can't change them. I can only change me. And blaming them was keeping me very stuck. So I found, because God just leads me. God is so good. Leads me to the next mentor, the next solution. And I found Shari Schreiber, who's an expert in borderline personality disorder. And swindler that I am, I convinced her that I could afford her services. I couldn't. And she saw through that very quickly. She's good. But anyway, I got a few good sessions out of her, and she was kind, and she even donated a session once, and I follow her. And I learned that I cannot tolerate my own rage, sadness, or guilt. No tolerance for these dark emotions. And so there is good old food to make those feelings go away and to hug me from the inside and keep me from having to feel rage, sadness, and guilt. And if I didn't learn to integrate my darker emotions into the repertoire of healthy emotions as a human being, I was going to kill myself with whatever substance I could.
That's really beautiful, because rarely do we have somebody that can articulate the emotions so specifically that they were intolerant of and were medicating. And so I think that's really instructive and really beautiful, because I can really relate to that. I medicated anger. I medicated anxiety. I medicated depression a lot. And I always say seemingly overwhelming emotions, because they do seem that way to me. And for many, many years, they just seemed so overwhelming that they were just going to swallow me whole. And I was terrified of what I would be capable of if I allowed those emotions to persist. Eject button, eject button, eject button. And for me, after my mom died and then being bullied for being the fat kid in middle school, that those emotions were so terrible. I never wanted to feel any of that again. And as soon as I found something that could take me out of it, boom. I mean, hello. And I think I became less and less tolerant of my emotions over time, too. Because I kept bailing out on them all the time. And so in recovery, it was very much a process of first identifying what certain emotions even felt like. When my body feels like this, that's fear, or that's anxiety, or that's loneliness. Because I had been medicating it for so long, it was a process, especially in early recovery, just to really correctly identify what emotions I was even feeling. And then giving myself some self-compassion around, it's okay to feel that way. And it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. And any one specific bout of emotion only lasts for a finite. It may feel like it lasts forever, but it only lasts for a finite period of time. And the saying, this too shall pass, was so critical for me in the beginning. This too shall pass. And recognize the emotion. Give myself some self-compassion around that emotion. It's okay to feel that way. This too shall pass. And then turn my attention to something positive, right? Maybe it's some recovery literature. Maybe it's, you know, doing some sort of healthy activity. And it's not a perfect, like, I didn't do it every single time, 100% all the time. Like, sometimes I defaulted to a bag of chips. It just happened. Like, that's real, right? You know, but it was a process of being able to do that on a more regular and consistent basis.
Yes. So once I had all the insight with these emotions, like, oh, wow, I can't tolerate how angry I am at my mother. Oh, I can't tolerate how guilty I feel about feeling sad or angry. And, you know, once I identified it, I was in a now what kind of place. And I had been to Al-Anon with someone else, because that's what we do, right? We drag people to meetings because they need it. But I knew in my heart of hearts, I've been procrastinating for too long. I need to humble myself and go to group. And these people, I love my group so much. And they even tell me, we see such a change in you. My God, shares, you've gotten just so much better. And, you know, now with the internet, now with, you know, with apps, you can tune in, do step, you know, over the steps, the slogans, everything can be right there on the phone. You don't even have to get out of bed. You can be looking at, you know, the ODAT or the Courage to Change, which I always have, like, you know, it's like always here. It's always here, like right at my fingertips. You got to have it. You got to have it. And if you're shaking and you can't look up the right date, you just open randomly to the page and read, and you're going to be helped. So, yeah, now I feel like I'm actually in recovery after all those steps to get to the steps.
That's absolutely beautiful. And I'm such a huge advocate of Al-Anon and CODA, another great codependency recovery program, and many of us who are in recovery from substance use, alcoholism, and addiction also identify as people that are in recovery from codependency. And I very much today am actively applying tools from Al-Anon in my own life with my adult children, as I watch them, especially my oldest child, who I love dearly and want to save them and want to, you know, fix it all and want to just, you know, and I realize that's about me. That's not about them. I can't tolerate the pain of watching them struggle. I don't want to save them for them. I want to save them for me. Right? And so, and I learned that from people like you, Lisa. And that's so beautiful. And I can stop and I can recognize that that's why I want to do that thing. And I can ask for help. to do the next right thing, which is really just be there for them and be the best example of recovery I can be on a daily basis. Which is so instructive and so helpful because I got all I can do to keep my eye on my own bobber. Okay? There's plenty of work to do here still on a daily basis. And some of the most valuable people in my life are the people that are able to demonstrate what it looks like to live in a healthy way. Right?
Yeah, and healthy has taken on, you know, the new dimension of being spiritually and emotionally healthy, being honest with myself so I can be honest with other people.
Absolutely. Tell me about the spiritual piece. How did that come into your recovery? What was that like for you?
I like to rely on my own understanding because I'm a know-it-all. That's how you get to be a professor. You just know it all.
Right.
And I got just gobsmacked in March of 2020. I was freaked out by everything that was going on. I was taken away from my classroom very abruptly. That is a place where I feel important and necessary. And as a codependent, it's sincere that I love and take care of my students, but now you've just pulled the nook-nook out of my mouth. Yeah. And now life is meaningless. And I was frightened about what was happening in the world. And I said, God, I am so sorry that I didn't recognize that there's such evil in the world and how badly I need you because I am not you. And thank God for apps. Thank God for apps. Oh, sorry, I keep forgetting we're not visual. I got the Hallow app. And it's a prayer and study app for Roman Catholics. You know, there's other apps for every religion. There's Insight Timer if you're Buddhist, you know, all of them. But I started a daily practice because I remember when I was blogging every day, how powerful that was. When I had a trajectory, when I had a goal and I was accountable and I showed up every day for a thing. And I'm like, well, now it's time to save my soul. And when you're immersed and, you know, I happen to be Roman Catholic, other religions have their beauty too and their wisdom. If you are plugged into your spirituality in a unique way every day, you will change. You will grow.
I love that. And by the way, Lisa, that is a great transition and segue into our closing questions. So are you ready for our closing questions?
Yes, I am.
So what does your daily or regular recovery routine consist of?
First thing in the morning, I roll over and I press play on my Hallow app. So there's prayer and study. And that goes on for between 1 and 2 hours. I have animals. So, you know, there's a lot of cleaning of cats while I listen to all the
Yeah.
then YouTube goes on and I put on something that's recovery related. If it's a TED talk, if it's a sermon, if it's a podcast, something. It's very important to me that I put positive things into my head. If I default, then it's just going to be destructive. So I do that. And then I do my, you know, I mean my work, my job, you know, professoring, there's all those duties. But as far as recovery, well, I teach recovery in my classes. I don't call it recovery, but I talk about the kind of habits that are good for them, not just, you know, to instruct them, oh, this is what this religion believes, but this is how this will make you better. Mindfulness. I teach them how to meditate. And then there's my social media, my quirky social media presence, where I post inspirational things on multiple, you know, places that I show up on the internet. And time permitting, I will make a video and talk about something that's developmental and growth oriented. And I have right now, I'm only going to a meeting once a week, but I absolutely go every week to my 12-step meeting.
Lisa, I heard spirituality in there. I heard connection in there. I heard spiritual and recovery literature in there. I heard teaching, which is just a huge part, I think, of recovery, being the student and the teacher, but integrating that into your professorial duties. That's a tremendous recipe for meaningful and enduring recovery. Lisa, what book or piece of recovery literature had the biggest impact on your recovery?
Yeah, that's a good one. I would say it was a book by Shari Schreiber, and I can't remember the title. It's one of those long-ass titles, but if you look up Shari Schreiber, you will find it. And it was all about, oh, do you need to be loved or do you love to be needed? I believe that's right. And that's when I finally had to admit that it's not just that I'm a victim of abuse. You know, I'm not going to take away the trauma of being abused by, you know, an alcoholic addict or narcissist, but that there's my responsibility. I can't change them. I didn't cause their disease, but I can only help myself. And if I don't heal the emotional wounds and behaviors inside me, I will continue to attract these abusers into my life. And so it was my responsibility to recover emotionally, spiritually, and psychologically.
What a great book recommendation we have not had. Do you need to be loved or do you love to be needed as a recommendation until this very moment? So that is absolutely fantastic and such an instructive message, which is at the core of Al-Anon and codependency recovery, which is letting go of other people, places, and things, and taking responsibility for the work we need to do to get well so that we can begin our journey of recovery and address the things that we need to address in order to live one day at a time, happy, joyous, and free.
That's right. One day at a time and do the next right thing. I like to sing it. Little Anna in Frozen 2. Do the next right thing.
Love that. Well, maybe this is another great segue into our next question, which is, what is the best piece of advice you've received in recovery?
It's one of the slogans. How important is it? You know, we pass around, we read our 12 steps, and then we read our slogans. How important is it? And sometimes I catch myself making a mountain out of a molehill to give myself permission to feel something.
Sure.
We don't need reasons to feel anything. We just feel them. And as you say, nothing lasts. Everything is temporary. That's something Buddhism teaches. Everything passes, the good and the bad. Nothing stays the same. So we grasp onto these problems and people so that we can have the adventure of feeling our own feelings. But really, how important is it?
I love that. And that's all about perspective.
Yes.
And I love that you're a professor of world religions, because I've integrated so much of many wisdom and spiritual traditions into my own recovery, Buddhism being a big part of that, and the central idea of attachment that is rooted in Buddhism. But all wisdom and spiritual traditions have universal truths within them that are applicable to humanity.
Yes, absolutely. They are all wisdom traditions, and they are all humanity's effort to reach to something higher than us. And that's why 12-step, well, it's one of the reasons I love 12-step, because they talk about a higher power non-specifically.
It's the only way I was able to develop my own spirituality was through the 12 steps. I hated God. I wanted no part of God after my mom died, because I have a very specific memory of somebody coming up to me at my mom's wake when I'm 11 years old saying, I guess God saw fit to take your mom early. And from that moment on, I made a very conscious decision. I want no part of a God that would do this to me. I don't need it. I don't want it. And I cloaked my resentment of God in agnosticism. But that wasn't real. I wasn't agnostic. I hated God. And so when I finally surrendered this last time, 8+ years ago, I wiped the slate completely clean because I knew the resentment against God was not serving me. It was killing me. But I couldn't invent a God that was going to save me. If I could think it up, it wasn't big enough for me. So I just started praying to a God that I had no concept of, that I had no idea of what it was, but I meant it. I really meant it with every fiber of my being. And it changed me in a profound way. Praying to this God that I didn't understand, that I had no concept of, changed me in a profound way. And so I have an experience of God. And that experience of God informs my understanding of God. And it's extremely powerful. And my understanding of God continues to evolve as my experience of God continues to manifest in my life.
Yeah, religion is a relationship. And many of the different world religions say that. You have to have a living relationship, whether it's with your higher power, your soul, your practice, whatever it is. It's not just a set of dogmas and rules and rituals. That would be very empty.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, a lot of people dog the dogma and the rules, don't they? But for a lot of people, they provide some guardrails, don't they, in terms of, you know, to give us a little bit of the rules of the road, right?
Yeah, ritual serves its purpose. But it's ritual alone and dogma alone won't heal you.
Agreed. I couldn't agree more, Lisa. Lisa, what is the greatest challenge you've had in recovery thus far?
The greatest challenge in recovery, I would say, having my knees replaced.
Oh, yeah.
So after I lost that initial 140 pounds, and, you know, I was exercising and leading little exercise groups with my students and doing so well, I started not being able to stand up and walk, and I didn't know what was going on. So the next book, so Diary of a Fat Girl is first, then it'll be From Wheelchair to Warrior, because I did indeed end up in a wheelchair for 2 years.
Oh, wow.
Not knowing, because I had no health insurance, not knowing what was going on. And it's very interesting journey from guru to guru, trying to figure out life until eventually I just prayed. And I'm like, God, I don't know what to do. Please help me. And I heard the Holy Spirit clearly in my head, and it doesn't happen often, clearly in my head said, find a surgeon. I'm like, whoa, Lord, thank you. But to have to get back up on my feet, literally and physically, was an exercise in incredible discipline.
Oh, wow. Lisa, I've heard many times that the knee is the most painful joint to have replaced and the most intense recovery from a joint. I am a guy that has had multiple surgeries on my right knee. I blew my ACL when I was a teenager, and then I tore out my meniscus about 10 years ago. And so I know that I have a knee replacement in my future at some point, and I'm kind of terrified of it, to be honest.
You will love having a titanium knee. You will love it. Yeah, the recovery's rough. So what?
Yeah, that's my joke. I'm going to have a bionic knee.
Yes, exactly. But the freedom it gives you, oh, it's delightful. But yeah, it is a rough recovery. I'm not going to lie, but it'll give you a lot to talk about and write about. And
Absolutely. I love that. I love that, Lisa. I absolutely love that. That's tremendous. Lisa, what is your greatest success in recovery thus far?
The recent breaking of a plateau that I held on to for well over 12 years.
What is that?
So I had gotten down to, I think, like 240 was the lowest I got. And then I was having regain and I was just up and down, up and down. And, you know, between going to meetings and being more disciplined and, you know, being more mindful of how I eat, I got myself down to the lowest was 219.
Wow.
And, you know, now you hover a little bit,
of course,
up and down, it's 5 pounds. And then, you know, but I finally broke that plateau. And I will continue to lose until I get to Wonderland, which is what they call any digit that starts with the number one.
Love that. That's absolutely fantastic. Congratulations, Lisa. That's great.
Thank you.
The next one's a doozy, and then we end with a fun one. What is something you haven't forgiven yourself or someone else for?
I can't forgive myself for being so impatient with my mother.
Mm.
She is not self-aware. She doesn't have what I have. And yet I become so furious with her. And sometimes I will yell at her. And it's like yelling at a child. She stopped developing emotionally probably at age 4.
Yeah.
And I lose my patience with her. She's 99.
Wow.
In a few months.
She's going to be 100 in a few months.
Yes.
Wow.
But
my
gosh.
That's very honest and very, very appreciated. The honesty that is, and relatable, by the way, very relatable. Here's the fun one. What song symbolizes recovery to you, Lisa?
I think is it Sia? She does that Unstoppable song.
Yes, absolutely. Tremendous recommendation, and one that we haven't had on the Way Out podcast as of yet. So that's great.
The idea, you got to keep going. And when you fall off the wagon, and just keep going. Go to a meeting, find a meeting, call your sponsor. Just don't stop. Don't give up.
Check the show notes right now for Lisa's contact information, and we'll have handy links to her social media channels as well as her book Diary of a Fat Girl. We have her Quitlet recommendation as well as her best piece of recovery advice and the song choice that symbolizes recovery for Lisa. Lisa, this was absolutely tremendous. Thank you so much for sharing your journey to and through recovery to this point with us.
Thank you for being an ally to people like me who are recovering and for letting an unconventional kind of addict come on to speak about her recovery path. I appreciate it.
You are so welcome, Lisa. And we're just humbled and honored to be able to elevate all stories of recovery because they all matter.
All recovery matters. Absolutely.
And thank you, everybody out there in Way Out Podcast Land. We will talk to you next time.
Thank you for being a part of The Way Out. We appreciate your ears. We're sharing powerful recovery stories and recovery power topics every week. So keep listening up. If you would like to reach out to the show, you can visit us on the web at wayoutcast.com. That's wayoutcast, all one word, .com. There you can subscribe to the Way Out podcast on all of the major podcast aggregators such as iTunes, Castbox, Stitcher, TuneIn, Podbean, Overcast, and more. Or simply drop your hosts a friendly email at share@wayoutcast.com. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on the show, contact us at share@wayoutcast.com. See you next time, and remember, if you don't change, your sobriety date will.